Welcome to season 4 of the Fit Farming Food Mom podcast. I am your host, Connie, world champion powerlifter, former bodybuilder, and elite trainer and nutrition coach. As a movement enthusiast and health nerd, I'm here on this show to speak with educated guests as we dive into the realm of all things health, fitness, mindset, and everything in between. If you enjoy the show, please do me a huge favor by smashing the like button or subscribing and leaving me a review. Now let's get to the show.
Now, this hibernation effect is also mimicked in animals. So animals that need to hibernate or fatten up for the winter will also use the polyunsaturated fats in order to do so. They actually need enough of the omega-6s to get into a hibernation state. So if you think about bears, they're normally eating a lot of the polyunsaturated fats in order to, a lot of nuts and seeds and also fatty fish, which are very high in the omega-3s, in order to get to that state. Squirrels, the same thing, eating acorns, which are going to be very high in the omega-6 fats. So that same effect is happening in us. Basically, what these fats do is they make it so that we can't efficiently produce energy from the food that's coming in. So when these fats are in our mitochondria, they basically are built into the structure there. The more of them we eat, the more that we use in the structure, and the less efficient our ability to produce energy is. And so it directly leads to the situation where we're, instead of converting that food to energy, we start to store it as fat, kind of like a hibernation state.
Welcome back to another episode. I'm so excited that you guys decided to spend your time with me today. That is awesome. As I'm sure you are busy, it is the holidays, and I know we are all running around like chickens with our heads cut off. Anyway, I am so excited today to have Jay Feldman on the podcast. Jay is a health coach, an independent health researcher, and he is also the host of the Energy Balance podcast. He has a degree in neuroscience as well as exercise physiology from the University of Miami, and he decided to forego medical school after realizing that the conventional medical approach was not the solution for health problems that so many of us face. He came across the idea that cellular energy is the foundation of our health, and he uses a bioenergetic approach to help men and women around the world maximize their cellular energy, optimize their health, and achieve freedom from low energy symptoms like chronic hunger and cravings, fatigue, brain fog, poor sleep, gut issues, and stubborn weight gain. Today, we talk about all things energy balance, what could be affecting it, nutrition, gut health, fats. We touch on it all, and I'm so excited for this episode. Before we get going, I want to remind you that LMNT does sponsor this podcast, and if you pop on over to their website at drinklmnt.com/Connie, you can get yourself a free sample pack, try the products out yourself. Right now, they have a fantastic seasonal arrangement of chocolate and chocolate caramel and chocolate mint, and they are all delicious in your coffee or served as a hot drink. So skip that hot chocolate that's full of sugar, jump on the LMNT train with sodium, potassium, and magnesium. They are all great for your health. Anyway, without further ado, here is my podcast with Jay Feldman. All right, Jay, I'm super excited to be welcoming you to the show. I think we have a lot of in common with our ways of thinking and stuff, and so it's always fun to chat with people about their experiences. So today we're going to talk a little bit about energy balance, what it is, why it matters, how nutrition factors in, and I'm really excited to dive into all of this.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for having me on, Connie.
So first off, I think Let's get a little of your background so that my listeners have an idea of who you are and what you do and what got you into this.
Yeah, so my interest in health and nutrition and fitness started when I was pretty young, and it was mostly from an optimization standpoint. I was trying to put on some muscle and worked out a lot, and I was an athlete, and so I was trying to optimize all those things, and nutrition is, part of that. And so I dug in and kind of had my own journey of finding things that worked, but mostly finding things that didn't work, and that exploration. And I was planning on going to medical school. So in college, while I was learning, about all the alternative health world and different focuses on nutrition, and at that time, paleo and keto were pretty big. And so that was the camp that I was in. I was doing cyclical ketogenic diets, and intermittent fasting, and things like that. And just based on that world, I had the idea, I was starting to really recognize that the conventional medical system while it has a role, just isn't the best from my view for helping people get healthy. And so I started to shift away from that. And at the same time, I was doing my own experimentation, my own research, and was with my goal of optimal health. I wasn't dealing with major health issues, but in my search for optimal health and trying these things, I was not only not feeling optimal, but I wasn't feeling as good as I was supposed to based on doing these things. And as somebody who's fully committed and, you know, will, you know, go full on keto or whatever it is, I wasn't feeling that great. The energy slumps were there. I was feeling a lot of restriction and cravings for carbohydrates. I wasn't performing as well in the gym. You know, I was doing some bodybuilding style workouts, but then shifted into powerlifting. And that was a bit of a struggle at that point. And then focused on classes and mood and libido and things that really shouldn't have been issues at that time started to become issues. And so I was in a situation where I was open to considering some alternative views. And that was when I came across what's called the bioenergetic view of health, which on its surface sounds, I would say, pretty logical, but the idea that basically the energy that we're producing in our cells is the driving force of our health. And so there's a lot of discussion as far as mitochondrial function goes nowadays, and even at that point. And so I think a lot of people can get on board with this idea that if our mitochondria are functioning well and our energy, you know, they're producing a lot of energy, that then that'll result in better health. But this, some of the nuances or detailed physiology and the understanding of this view actually pointed to the opposite of a lot of what people were suggesting and a lot of what I was doing as far as the fasting and carb restriction and other things along those lines. So I started to dive into that view and experiment with it, and had just felt a world of difference. And I think one of the biggest things was a shift from this idea that our bodies are innately fighting against us, and that they, if we are left to our own devices, we'll just become unhealthy and we'll just, you know, sit on the couch and eat junk food and become overweight and diseased. Instead, to an idea where our bodies are not actually fighting against us, and instead they're super intelligent and trying to adapt to the environment that we're giving them. And if we actually listen to their signals and respond appropriately, that can actually be something that's way more supportive of our health. And so that was a big shift for me from the willpower, restriction, forcing sort of mindset to shifting toward a mindset of more abundance. And I'm sure we'll dig into that in more detail and what that looked like. But that was something that shifted the way I saw the world, my outlook on so many things, but especially when it came to health. And so that shifted my trajectory. And since that point, I've really dug into researching quite a bit and coaching other people and helping people to implement these new principles that they can use to not only help with body composition, but also to help with pretty major symptoms like chronic health issues, autoimmune issues, and on from there. And so that's what I do currently as a health coach. And I have a podcast and write articles and things like that. So.
Awesome. Well, I think there's a lot to unpack here. I do want to note one thing that you were talking about, and that was the different factors involved with people's things and the all-in mentality, right? I think no matter what approach we make to health or nutrition, our body is always trying to find homeostasis. So if we go in extreme one direction, our body is going to try to adapt to that. So I do like what you said about it trying to work with us instead of against us. Really, it's just trying to keep that thermostat set at a certain number. And so sometimes we have a tendency to get in the way of that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we have this idea that we need to fight against those things, and that's the way to health, right? It's calorie restriction. It's not eating a lot. It's fasting and avoiding all of the things that are supposed to taste good, and forcing ourselves to do the cold baths and the hours and hours of cardio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can relate with this on so many levels, right? I used to be that person, and that's the part that, you know, I'm thankful for it. I hate that I ever did that to myself, but on the other side of the spectrum, I'm so very thankful that that's something that I did, because now I know what not to do. But sadly, you see it happening frequently. People think that they need to over restrict and do more cardio and do more exercise in order to look a certain way, when that's just not true.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be very freeing to recognize that, and to, you know, maybe not initially, but as somebody starts to implement these things. And I know it was for me. I mean, it was a complete night and day change as far as being in a state of constant restriction for years and years, always, you know, fighting against the desire to eat more, to eat the carbohydrates, and to have that freedom from that and recognizing that we can actually give our bodies what they need. And that can turn our hunger signals off and we can feel totally satisfied, not the kind of satisfied when we fill up on water and salads and like just have a full belly, but like actually nourished and feel like we don't, like the binges don't happen, right? It's not like one of those scenarios anymore where you have to constantly fight against those signals. So yeah, it was night and day difference for me.
I love it. Well, so let's kind of dive into this a little bit, into the energy balance / bioenergetic side of this. Like, what does this look like and why are these words so important?
Yeah. So in terms of energy balance, I think some people are more familiar with it as a term that means more of calorie balance, which is the idea of calories in, calories out, and that equating to weight balance. But that's not really what I'm referring to at all when I'm talking about energy balance. And instead, what I'm focusing on or describing is the balance of energy in our body. So the energy that's produced in our mitochondria is called ATP. And so there's a lot of sensors that are always going on. You mentioned kind of homeostatic balance. And I would say that really what our bodies are sensing is the amount of energy available versus what we're using. So our energy supply versus our energy demands. And that's that balance that I'm referring to. And in essence, from this bioenergetic view, the goal is to produce as much energy as possible and have excess energy to go to greater function. And that requires digging into the actual things that are going to support our ability to produce energy. So this is not, again, in contrast with the calorie balance idea, which is just however much food you take in, that equals energy. Instead, there are a ton of steps between the food coming in and the energy we produce. And most people do not produce energy well from the food that they're coming in. They do it very inefficiently. And then you have all this excess food that then gets stored as body fat. And then you're in a low energy state, but also a state where your body composition is worsening or isn't where you want it to be. And the lack of energy causes all sorts of issues. Not only are you tired and fatigued, but that's the same energy that allows for skin and hair and nail growth. It's the same energy that allows for good digestion and good immune function and good reproductive function and hormonal balance. So this is a crucial, crucial piece. And so the main focus that I would argue that we want to take is to focus on improving our ability to produce energy from the foods that are coming in. And that also involves changing the types of foods that are coming in, but it can also involve making sure we're getting certain nutrients or avoiding certain other things that are sometimes called nutrients. Making sure that we're getting enough sunlight or sleep, things like that. We can break down, you know, each of the factors, but focusing on improving our ability to produce energy from the foods that are coming in, and also making sure not to be wasting excessive amounts of energy on things that aren't actually going to support our health and function. And so a lot of the things that we are told to be doing nowadays, whether it is fasting or the ice baths, or, I don't know, calorie restriction, I mean, are all situations where, or excessive exercise, these are all situations where we're wasting energy that actually comes at the cost of our own function, actually leads to the deterioration because we don't have the energy to support our function and our structure. So that's basically where I'm coming from when I'm talking about energy balance.
Okay, I like this. So how can we be more efficient with the foods that we are eating so that it can take us to a better energy balance?
Yeah, so that requires digging into some of the factors that are going to affect our ability to produce energy. And a handful of those will be centered around the actual foods that are coming in. And so that's probably a good place to start, which is basically that in order to produce energy, I think one of the most basic ideas that a lot of people can get on board with is we need to have certain nutrients. We need to have certain vitamins and minerals in order to convert the carbohydrate or fat to energy. And a lot of people who are eating standard diets nowadays are not getting those nutrients. Even a lot of people who are eating what they think are healthy diets, what we're told are healthy diets nowadays, are not getting those nutrients, because when you just look at the amount of nutrients in a food, that doesn't mean we're going to be absorbing all of those nutrients. And so that's another important piece as well. But so the basic point I'm saying here is that we need to make sure that we have the nutrients available, the B vitamins, the magnesium, the zinc, all the different components necessary to produce energy. And so that involves eating foods that have that nutrient density and also avoiding foods that are actually going to make it harder to absorb certain nutrients. And these are These involve a lot of the anti-nutrients that are talked about pretty widely in the like ancestral health, paleo, carnivore worlds.
Mm-hmm. For example, can you give us some of those anti-nutrients that could inhibit our ability to absorb things properly?
Yeah, so anti-nutrients are a pretty wide class of compounds, but it involves lectins, oxalates, phytates or phytic acid or oxalic acid. There's a handful of other, there are certain goitrogens and saponins. The central point here, the central idea is that anti-nutrients are chemical defenses in plants, and they tend to be concentrated in the seeds and in the leaves, and they're there to protect the plants from being eaten by predators. So the plant seeds are extremely important to the plant. They need those to reproduce. They don't have any seeds that are still left, then they don't make it very far as far as reproduction, and they don't survive. So they have a lot of defensive chemicals in there, because unlike an animal that has claws or teeth that can protect itself, a plant can't do that. And so it has these chemical compounds in there to protect it from being eaten. When an organism eats those things, or let's just keep it focused on humans or even mammals, it can cause a lot of problems. And so some of those problems involve binding with the minerals and vitamins in the food and preventing us from absorbing them. It can also involve preventing us from breaking down and digesting protein or digesting starches. And so not only do we not get these nutrients, but then they go down to farther in our intestines, farther to our large intestine, and feed bacteria and create a harmful dysbiotic microbiome. Mm-hmm. And there's some others that can cause something else that's talked about very widely, which is called leaky gut or intestinal permeability. And so people will point a lot to gluten as one of the main ones. So gluten is an anti-nutrient. It's in the lectin category. And these things can really cause some dramatic problems. And we can dig in a little bit into more detail into intestinal permeability, because that situation is one that definitely contributes to some issues with being able to produce energy. So that class of compounds is pretty big one to be aware of. And those are mostly going to be found in seeds from the plants, which are not just seeds to us, but it's also seeds, nuts, legumes, and grains. And then also they're going to be highly concentrated in the leaves of the plants, which to us are the leafy green type vegetables. So, you know, spinach, kale, things like that. The good news as far as all those go is there are certain things we can do to reduce the anti-nutrients in those foods. So when it comes to the leafy greens, we can just cook them. Normally that'll break down most of the anti-nutrients. When it comes to the grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, we can process them in traditional ways. We can ferment them or soak and sprout them. Those things do go pretty far away as far as reducing the anti-nutrient content. Mm-hmm. I still would say it doesn't necessarily make them ideal foods, depending on the specifics there, but those are at least things I would be doing if somebody really wants to include those foods in their diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your feelings on like a lot of those types of foods in a prebiotic sense, or, food for your microbiota?
So when we're talking prebiotic, what we're talking about is simply anything that's going to feed the bacteria in our large intestine. So typically it's something that we don't absorb, and instead reaches the colon, and then we'll feed the bacteria there. And there's a variety of different types of fibers, and it's going to vary based on individual foods, but also groups of foods. So fruits are going to be high in fiber, vegetables, whether it's like root vegetables or more like the leaf type vegetables, kind of all sorts of ones in between the bulbs and everything. Those will all have different amounts of fibers or other fermentable carbohydrates that are all prebiotics. And the problem, so fiber in and of itself, I would say, is in most cases isn't problematic. There are certain ones that are, but in most cases, the fiber isn't the problem, but rather if somebody has an issue with their gut microbiome, and this is really, really common, that we have overgrowth of harmful bacteria, not enough of the beneficial ones. Maybe it's overgrowth of fungi. This can happen due to not having enough energy for good digestion, leading to issues with the microbiome. It can be due to slow motility, where the food is moving very slowly through the intestines and the bacteria grow more and more and higher up in the intestines and create what's called a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO. This can also be due to years of antibiotics, you know, especially early on, or not being breastfed. I mean, there's all sorts of things that in our modern world are going to lead to issues with our microbiome. So somebody has an issue with their microbiome, which is very common, and then eats things that have fiber in it, they're going to be feeding those, or any prebiotics, they're going to be feeding those bacteria, the harmful ones that have overgrown. And that's going to cause a lot of issues, a lot of symptoms. That doesn't mean that the fiber is inherently problematic, but what it does mean is normally for that individual, we would want to lean away from most fibers and work on fixing digestion and fixing the microbiome, and then later on introduce certain fibers from certain foods to help regrow, I would say, more beneficial bacteria.
Mm-hmm. I feel that's been a big pandemic, honestly, with our health, is our, obviously, our GI issues and stuff like that. You see so many people taking proton pump inhibitors because they have terrible acid reflux. Next thing you know, that environment is not acidic enough to keep the bad bugs at bay like they're supposed to be, and you have a problem right there. You have stress, which also inhibits our actual natural pH. There's so many factors there. So, or how about people think they need to take a probiotic in order to help with their digestion when that might not be the case? They may actually be contributing to a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned stomach acid. If we're not only is that, can that allow for bacterial growth in the stomach even, but also if we're not, if we don't have acidic enough stomachs and then we're consuming a decent amount of protein and not breaking that protein down and absorbing it, then that will go and feed bacteria in the large intestine and causes a lot of issues there. So, you know, like allows for the overgrowth of some pretty harmful bacteria. And so, yeah, there's a ton of issues that come when we can't break our food down well due to low stomach acid or low bile flow or a lack of digestive enzymes. So those are certainly things to consider. And yeah, if somebody is in a compromised state, which is normally the situation when they're going to take a typical probiotic, those probiotics can then actually overgrow in places we don't want, like the small intestine. So there's studies that have shown that in people who are compromised, whether it's due to an infection that they then took antibiotics for or whatever it is, or they already have a compromised gut, which as we said is the most, like the majority of people, then taking a probiotic can lead to SIBO with the specific strains that were in the probiotic. So basically you're leading to an overgrowth of the bacteria in the wrong place and causing way worse issues. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean all probiotics are inherently problematic. I mean, it really depends, but in general, it's normally not something I'd be going to in that situation.
Mm-hmm. So obviously nutrition is a huge part of energy balance. What are some other factors in this?
So we mentioned the digestion side and avoiding the anti-nutrients. And the kind of flip side of that is favoring the really easily digestible foods or more easily digestible foods. And that's going to be a central piece. The other reason, just to add another layer of importance to not feeding harmful bacteria, is that the toxins that those bacteria produce, and when I say toxins, I'm sure you know some people have like a reflexive, like oh, we're talking something woo-woo or whatever, I'm talking about actually toxic things. So one of the most well-known or well-documented or ones that's our research the most is called lipopolysaccharide or LPS. It's also called endotoxin. And that's produced by certain types of bacteria. And when we feed those bacteria and they produce a lot, first off, that endotoxin can cause intestinal permeability on its own. And then that means that that endotoxin will get absorbed. That endotoxin is so potently toxic to our mitochondria that it will create septic shock and death in somebody who has a very severe infection. This is normally not something that an average person has to worry about, but the point that I'm bringing up here is just how potent it is. And we find more mild levels of what's called endotoxemia, basically toxic exposure to endotoxin in most or a ton of different chronic health conditions like diabetes and fatty liver disease, obesity. So this is a central area that is going to inhibit our ability to produce energy from our food if we have a lot of this endotoxin exposure. So favoring the easily digestible foods is massively important, makes a huge difference. I would say it's one of the biggest differences as far as getting our ability to produce energy back up or back to where it should mm-hmm. be for optimal health. So
what are some, sorry, I love Zoom. Their delay always makes it a little harder to ask questions. But so what are some of the easily digestible foods that we could maybe target initially in a health journey?
Yeah, so the things that I'd be focusing on, and again, it will vary a little bit depending on exactly how compromised somebody's gut is.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be focusing on, from the protein side, largely, meat and seafood. And that's especially going to be meat and seafood that's low in the polyunsaturated fats, the omega-6s and omega-3s, which is probably the next category I think is worth digging into. So that's what I would focus on as far as protein, as well as also dairy and people who do well with dairy. Normally, if someone's particularly compromised gut-wise, they're going to be more sensitive and more likely to have issues there. But really can vary on the individual, and that is something that can improve over time. But I would say as far as easily digestible things go, for somebody who's not sensitive, dairy would fall in that category as well. On the protein side. And then as far as fats go, favoring, again, the more saturated and monounsaturated fats and avoiding the polyunsaturated. And this is due to a handful of reasons. We'll talk about the effects on mitochondria and energy production, but also on digestion. The more saturated fats are better able to stimulate bile flow, and the production of and release of bile is what helps not only digest fat, but it helps keep our small intestine clear. It's the main thing that's going to kill off any bacteria in the small intestine. And so if you don't have enough bile flowing, that can lead to a state that involves SIBO or it can lead to SIBO. So that's another central reason why I would want to lean toward saturated and monounsaturated fats. Again, sometimes someone can be so compromised with their digestion that they can't digest those saturated fats well. So that's a situation I might lean on the monounsaturated fats more. And so this is going to be, as far as the more saturated ones, we've got butter, coconut oil, beef tallow, you know, fat from beef or bison or lamb, goat, things like that, ghee, you know, along with butter. And palm oil is going to be largely saturated. And then on the monounsaturated side, we have olive oil and avocado oil as well, although I'd probably lean more toward the olive oil than avocado. Also macadamia nuts, macadamia nut oil, those are all going to be mostly monounsaturated fats. And so those are the types of fats I would largely be sticking to. And then we can talk about, well, I guess I'll just mention it now and we'll talk about why, but really wanting to avoid the polyunsaturated fats. And so those are going to be fats that are found in most nuts and seeds. And so all of the vegetable oils, the seed oils that are used for cooking in pretty much every single restaurant, is those are going to be very high in the polyunsaturated fats, which are hugely problematic for our ability to produce energy. And then polyunsaturated fats are also going to be particularly high in certain types of animal foods. So chicken and pork that are not raised on, you could say, a natural diet, even though yeah, we'll have to dig into the specifics there. But if they're raised on a typical feed, they're going to be very high in the polyunsaturated fats. So those would be ones that we'd want to lean away from in that case, or just lean to the very lean cuts. So like chicken breast is going to be low in the polyunsaturated fats.
Well, certain, you know what they say is you are what you eat. If you're feeding this animal corn, or I mean, if you're feeding it polyunsaturated fats, it's going to be polyunsaturated fats.
Yeah. And that's true for, so, it, and there is some variability in species. So it's true for us. It's true for chickens and pigs. For ruminant animals like cows and goats and lamb and bison, those ones, even if they're fed high polyunsaturated fats, they're still going to be largely saturated in terms of their own fat content. So that's one situation where if you can't get really well-raised animals to eat, then leaning toward those types is going to be much better, because even if they're grain-fed, they're going to have still very, very low amounts of the polyunsaturated fats. And that's also the case for dairy too. Like the milk is not going to be high in polyunsaturated fats.
Yeah, so this is actually another huge problem in the health and nutrition space, right? Is if you, I'll just say for me, polyunsaturated fats are a hard no. If something says vegetable oil or canola oil on it, I am absolutely not going to consume it. I don't even make room for it if as a cheat day or whatever it may be, right? It's a hard no for me. But it's become highly problematic for people. And how is that? Why is it such a problem?
Yeah, they're ubiquitous. There's a few reasons why the polyunsaturated fats are problematic. And so for one, I will, so the, as you mentioned, the types of canola oil, soy oil, grapeseed oil, all those things are going to be very high. Sunflower seed oil, pretty much any of those oils, any plant oils other than palm or olive or coconut are going to be largely polyunsaturated. And also nuts. So when I was in the kind of paleo world, I was eating a lot of nuts, but nuts are very, very high in polyunsaturated fats, other than macadamia nuts, and hazelnuts aren't too bad either. But for the most part, those are all going to be very high in the polyunsaturated fats. And so these fats, I think the first thing that's helpful is to consider their role in nature. And so in the, you know, we talked about anti-nutrients and their role. Well, the role of polyunsaturated fats is largely for hibernation. So the seeds and nuts, which nuts are just seeds, that have these polyunsaturated fats, They have to survive in very cold conditions throughout the winter so that they can then germinate in the spring and be active in these cold temperatures. And so they need polyunsaturated fats. And so this is why in colder regions, you see much higher levels of polyunsaturated fats in the seeds. Whereas in more tropical regions, you have something like coconut that's going to be very saturated. But even if you grow the same type of seed in a warmer climate, it'll have less polyunsaturated fats and more saturated fats. Now, this hibernation effect is also mimicked in animals. So animals that need to hibernate or fatten up for the winter will also use the polyunsaturated fats in order to do so. They actually need enough of the omega-6s to get into a hibernation state. So if you think about bears, they're normally eating a lot of the polyunsaturated fats in order to, you know, a lot of nuts and seeds, and also fatty fish, which are very high in the omega-3s, in order to get to that state. Squirrels, the same thing, you know, eating acorns, which are going to be very high in the omega-6 fats. So that same effect is happening in us. Basically, what these fats do is they make it so that we can't efficiently produce energy from the food that's coming in. So when these fats are in our mitochondria, they basically are built into the structure there. The more of them we eat, the more that we use in the structure, and the less efficient our ability to produce energy is. And so it directly leads to the situation where we're, instead of converting that food to energy, we start to store it as fat, kind of like a hibernation state. So we're left with low energy, low body temperature, all the things that come with a low metabolic state, and then increasing fat storage. And so that's really the central reason why I would say we don't want to have these fats. And there's a handful of others, you know, we could dig into if you'd like. And some of it's more biochemistry related, so probably not interesting to most people. But even as an important aside, there's some really great research showing that the more polyunsaturated fats that we have in our fats in our body, like in our structural fats, the faster we age and the shorter our lifespan. And this isn't just the case in humans. This is across all species. So if you look at any species and how much of the polyunsaturated fats they have in their structural fats, the more that they have, the shorter their lifespan is going to be. And then vice versa, the fewer of those they have, the more, the longer they'll live and the slower they age. So it's one of the most central pieces to our health as a whole. And the mediating factor there is based on our ability to produce energy.
So I want to kind of touch on this a little. I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why we shouldn't be eating polyunsaturated fats. So it's always been a part of my thinking that obviously it's not optimal. So our body doesn't want to burn it. And if we are consuming that on and storing it on a large basis, it's going to be harder for us to maintain a proper body composition because our body is not going to want to go to that as an energy resource.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's certainly the more that we consume and store, the tougher it can be and the more problems we can have as far as body composition goes. And sometimes it can cause a problem, especially if our fat stores do have a lot of the polyunsaturated fats. It can make it even tougher when we're trying to lose body fat. But yeah, these are basically one of the central pieces that are going to turn down our energy production and turn down our metabolic dials, turn us into that kind of hibernation state where not only do we not have the energy to do things, but all of our own functions are turned down. Our immune function, our digestion, our reproductive function, our brain function, I mean, everything is turned down in that state. So yeah, definitely something I would say is not conducive to health.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about digestion. We talked about polyunsaturated fats and our omegas that are important or ones to avoid. What are some other factors in our overall energy balance?
Yeah, so the one category we didn't get to when it came to foods, which I think is an important one to get to now and is one of those third factors, is the carbohydrate side of things. So in talking about things that tend to drive hibernation and a kind of low metabolic state, removing carbohydrates and relying largely on fat for our fuel is one of those things. And this is something that has, again, the same biological evolutionary basis, which is that fat is our storage fuel. And so when we don't have food coming in and we are fasting for a period of time, or we're starving and we're in a famine, if we think more on the evolutionary basis, we're going to be relying on fat as our fuel. And when that happens, the most beneficial thing that our bodies can do is turn down their metabolism, because when we don't have a lot of food coming in, then we want to be able to survive as long as possible. We're not worried about being able to reproduce or to be focusing at our best or anything like that. We need to be able to survive. And so we need to turn down our metabolic rate. So when we rely on just burning fat for our fuel, it relays those same signals. And there are some biochemical signals that are doing this and also some hormonal signals that are doing this. And so this is one of my biggest gripes or concerns when it comes to low-carb diets, ketogenic diets, anything, you know, carnivore diets, anything along those lines, which is that avoiding those carbohydrates is going to send those same signals. And so instead, I would say that we would want to make sure that we're including enough carbohydrates to support optimal hormonal health, to support our brains, which have very high energy demands, to support our kidneys and our liver, and also our muscles, especially if we're doing any sort of higher intensity work there. And within those, we would certainly want to focus on the ones that are easy to digest. So we mentioned before, like we're not wanting to lean toward the grains, for example, which for in the conventional world, that's where we're supposed to be getting all of our carbs from, right? The breads and pastas and everything. But instead, I would say we want to lean toward the much easier to digest carbohydrate sources. So this is going to be fruit-based sources. So ripe fruit and dried fruit, maybe some fruit juice, depending on scenario, you know, different contexts. And also cooked carbohydrates that are going to be easily digested as well. So the starchier things like roots and tubers or plantains. So as far as the roots and tubers, we're talking potatoes, sweet potatoes, also things like squashes. Those would all be the types of carbohydrates that I would be leaning toward.
I like that you bring this up because so many people feel they need to avoid carbohydrates, but they actually really have their place. And I can't tell you how many times I've run lab work on people that are trying to do a ketogenic diet and they're not eating enough, because of the amount of fat consumption. And then B, you see a lot of their stress markers have gone up in their lab work because, I mean, there is a, trust me, I'm not against the ketogenic or low carbohydrate way of life at all. It's worked well for me in certain contexts. And I think that's what everybody needs to understand is we are all so unique and individual. There are a lot of nuances to what is needed, right? But we need to make sure that we're supporting that. So whilst I might have been successful doing ketogenic diet for a period of time, I also utilized it strategically. It wasn't just like no carbs. I was training heavily at the time. Everything was perfectly timed. Was there carbs involved? Yes. Did I stay in ketosis? Yeah, also yes, but I was able to utilize carbs for my energy resources. So I think I'm not against keto at all, but I think a lot of people are using it wrong. And in our current society, I think so many people are under so much stress that it's not a good tool to put in their toolbox.
Yeah. So a couple of things I would come back to. So one carbohydrate kind of category I forgot to mention would be like honey and maple syrup. Those are some other really easily digestible sources. But yeah, there are some, I think, inherent, you mentioned like increases in stress symptoms or stress signs when it comes to low carb diet. And I think that that's really key. So the main hormonal situation that's going to mediate or tell our bodies that we're not in a state of abundance where we have a lot of energy, but instead we're in a situation of famine or starvation or fasting or whatever that is going to involve the stress hormones. And so the first thing that happens when we don't have those carbohydrates coming in is our blood sugar will drop at some point and it has to be propped up. And the main way that we do that is with certain stress hormones, which are glucagon, growth hormone to an extent, and also adrenaline and cortisol. And so one thing that I know completely changed the way that I looked at food and how I felt and was just an absolute game changer for me was this recognition that the stress hormones are there to provide fuel when we don't have enough energy available. They do that, you know, through the blood sugar. They also provide some fat as well for when we need it. This is going to happen anytime we exercise, anytime that we're in a psychologically stressful situation. It's going to happen anytime we go for too long without eating or if we don't have carbohydrates. And the best and quickest way to turn down those stress hormones is not going to be just with some deep breathing or taking some magnesium. You know, these are the things that I was recommended to do to lower my cortisol, but instead taking in carbohydrates is the most immediate way to drop those stress hormones down. And that's because they're directly antagonistic. It's a directly opposite relationship where if we provide that fuel that we need to produce the energy, it turns those stress hormones down. That's the only reason the stress hormones were up in the first place. So that was something that really shifted my mindset. And if we take that a step further, basically, in this situation where we avoid the carbohydrates, it's going to lead to these sorts of stress signals that over time will lead to turning down our larger, higher level functions, our thyroid activity, our reproductive activity. Often it's going to lead us into a high adrenalized state where we might not sleep very well. We might end up with insomnia. We might feel really good. We might feel like we have a lot of energy, but in essence, I would say we're running on borrowed time, kind of like having, you know, coffee on an empty stomach with the jitteriness and everything that comes with that. We're just relying on the stress hormones. And so that's my biggest concern there, and something that, as you were kind of alluding to, I mean, I see all the time in people coming from these low carb situations where we're seeing the excess cortisol, we're seeing the low T3 or elevated reverse T3, meaning low thyroid activity as a result of the stress. We're seeing turned down libido, and with that, the hormones that go with it, testosterone coming down, or for women, all sorts of issues cycle wise, or even just amenorrhea in more extreme cases. And it's more extreme, but not necessarily so uncommon for those sorts of things to come up. So those are some major consequences of this sort of stress, of this sort of avoidance of carbohydrates.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm definitely seeing the same things on labs as well. So I find that interesting. So what is another factor involved in our energy balance, and how can we optimize it?
Yeah, so we've, I guess, talked about three at this point. So we've talked, we talked about nutrients. We talked about the endotoxin digestion piece. Talked about carbs versus fats. And then we also talked about the polyunsaturated fats versus the saturated fats. So those four, I would say, are some of the most common, most important, but there are others too. And so some of the other ones that might come to mind, I mean, in more rare cases, there can be issues with some other kind of major toxins like heavy metals or mold exposure. All of those things will directly impair are the ability for our mitochondria to produce energy. That's why they're toxic. That's the means through which they have their effects. And so I think it's pretty rare. It's not never, but it's pretty rare that I'm getting to a point where those things are major issues with clients, but sometimes it does line up and that can be an issue. The other thing is the chronic infections, and that can also often go back to gut health, but it can also be something that that can happen somewhat independent of the gut, but normally is the result of the same low metabolism, low immune function, and then we're stuck with these chronic infections. So they're causing the same sorts of toxins, the same sort of endotoxin that will inhibit our ability to produce energy. Mm-hmm. So that would be another piece. But we also have some of the more basic lifestyle things, something like getting enough sleep or moving. And those, I think, are central and sometimes they're chicken or the egg situations where maybe something else is impairing our ability to sleep. But if we're not getting enough sleep, I mean, I see it so often, or relatively often, where someone's looking to lose weight, but they're sleeping, let's say, 5 or 6 hours a night. And it's somebody who's maybe kind of high charging, or they're really busy with work and they've got their life going on. But there's some pretty clear research showing us that there is a huge consequence to that. Just sleeping, you know, 6 hours a night versus 8 hours a night, and seeing pretty dramatic changes in fat loss, even if both groups are eating the same amount of calories and they're both in the deficit and all of that. The groups that sleep more have way more fat loss, way less loss of lean mass. And so that's a very central component as well.
It's a hugely related to your appetite as well.
Yeah, and insulin sensitivity, like our ability to use the carbs that are coming in, those things are all affected by our sleep. And it's very stressful. I mean, anybody who sleeps a couple hours less than they normally do knows that effect, right? I mean, you feel it, you can't function normally. And there's very few things that most people can experience that will affect their functioning so much. Mm-hmm. But I think what often happens is we get stuck, like after we've gone from, let's say, 8 or 9 hours a night to 7 hours a night or 6 hours a night, and that becomes our norm. We've already adapted to that, and we've forgotten that difference between how we used to feel and how we feel currently. I think it's one that we want to be on top of and reevaluate. So I think that's a central point when it comes to putting our health first.
Sleep is definitely one of the non-negotiables on my end of things. Anybody that knows me knows that if they're like, hey, want to go out to dinner? I'm like, no, because I have to wake up. I naturally wake up without an alarm at 6 a.m. every day. I don't compromise my bedtimes. It is the same every single day. I sleep well, and that it is one of my main focuses, and it is hugely impactful to my overall health.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people struggle with sleep. I mean, it's one of the more common issues I see. And there's a handful of other things that I think can be related. So any of the things we've mentioned so far, the gut issues or the not getting enough carbohydrates are central. I think not eating enough overall can be a central point there. So that's something I would consider, but also the meal timing. So we were talking about cortisol, the relationship with carbohydrate intake, the relationship with blood sugar. But so when it comes to fasting, where we're not eating a meal, if we think about that in the context of sleep and our circadian rhythm and look at what happens in the morning, basically when we're asleep, it's a situation or a time when we don't have any food coming in. So we're running off of our stored food, especially our stored carbohydrate, the glycogen that's in our liver. Mm-hmm. And even though our bodies aren't physically active, our brains are still pretty active overnight. So they're using all that carbohydrate. And as that carbohydrate runs out, it starts to increase the stress hormones. And you mentioned waking up without an alarm. That happens because we have our own internal alarm clock that goes off normally after however many, let's say 8, 9 hours, whatever it is, that involves an increase in cortisol, a spike in cortisol. That's the one time really that we want to have that major spike. And of course, like if we're exercising or something, maybe we want to have it, but we want to kind of minimize it. But anyway, that spike is normal to have in the morning. The biggest thing, or the thing that's going to help us turn that cortisol down when we wake up, is having breakfast, having some carbohydrates in the morning. That's going to be the central thing that'll turn down those stress hormones. And if we don't do that and we decide instead we're fasting and we're going to wait until lunch to eat, then we're going to be running on elevated levels of cortisol and adrenaline in the morning, especially if we then have coffee on top of that too. But even if we don't, we're still running on those stress hormones. And so that's a really good way to interrupt our normal circadian rhythm, because now our stress hormones have been elevated all the way through to midday. And a lot of people experience issues with sleep as a result of that. And so sometimes it's just a matter of eating more consistently throughout the day and also making sure to get enough nutrition in the morning. It can go a pretty long way when it comes to sleep.
I love that. Well, are there any other pieces out there that you think would be important for our listener today? What's the best way for them to get started knowing that they have a proper energy balance, or to start to achieve that?
Yeah, as far as places to start, I think experimentation and awareness are key, and paying attention. And that's a skill. It's not something that it's a skill that we can train and untrain. And I think it's not something that most people have trained and instead have largely untrained. And part of that, I think, is because of the restrictive backgrounds we're coming from, where we've intentionally untrained ourselves to tune into our body signals, where instead we're using whatever external idea that we're supposed to eat this many calories or this many, this number of grams of carbohydrates or protein. We've tried to tune ourselves out to our own intuitive eating signals, our own hunger signals. And we do that with pretty much everything we do. I mean, we, you know, in our modern life, we live inside. We don't use the sun as an indicator of anything. Nobody gets tired at 8 o'clock when the sun's down because they've got all their lights on in the house and they're watching TV, you know, with all the blue light. I mean, there's so many ways that we have disconnected from our human selves and our environment around us that used to exist or still exists in a few places. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those are starting to rekindle that is a central piece. So starting to, and this can come in a number of forms, but just paying attention to how we feel throughout the day and trying to consider how the things that we do affect it, whether it's certain foods that we eat or don't eat, or how much sleep we got, or if we took a walk that day, or if we went to the gym that day or did yoga or whatever it is. I think that is the first step, is starting to make those connections and then starting to experiment. You know, it doesn't have to be major overhauls of what we're doing. It doesn't have to be tracking, you know, weighing everything you eat and tracking it. I think those things can be helpful and they all have their place. And I think doing a food log or tracking your food can sometimes be really eye-opening for people who have no idea that alcohol was making up 30% of their calories, or that they were only getting 50 grams of fat a day or whatever, or 50 grams of protein a day or whatever it is. So I think that just taking those steps to considering what you're doing and how you feel is key. I think that's central. And then making small tweaks, small, you know, experiments one step at a time. You know, so often when people are coming to me, it's it's a situation where they are committed, they are working on their health, they've been doing it for a while, but especially when trying newer things, maybe they've started to come across these ideas. It's all these changes food-wise, plus all these new supplements to try to remedy these other issues, and everything's all at once. And normally one of the first things I'm doing is slowing all that down, kind of stripping it back, and just doing one thing at a time and giving it some time for our bodies to adapt, mm-hmm. see how we respond, and then making the next change. Mm-hmm. And I think one other thing that can really allow for that is shifting toward a long-term view of our health. So, or even just shifting toward a view of our health, shifting toward trying to be healthy as opposed to just trying to lose a certain amount of weight by summer or a certain amount of weight by the end of the month or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's just, that's what we're programmed to now, right? A diet, the goal of a diet is to lose a certain number of weight in a certain period of time, mm-hmm. Or of a supplement, you know, whatever it is. And so I think reprioritizing, putting our health first and putting the long-term view in mind, which is easy when we're doing something that actually nourishes us and works with our body signals. Because when you're trying to do something that really doesn't feel good and has to be forced and requires a ton of willpower, it has to be short term, mm-hmm. because you know that you can't sustain that for an extended period of time. And if you did, it's really going to be difficult. And you know that you only have so much time left in order to be able to do it. You have to get that 10 pounds down in a month because you know that you can't sustain it for longer.
Right, right. And I think that's a huge thing, honestly. I can even use myself as an example, as I'm sure you probably can in other scenarios, is at one point I was so focused on how I looked, when all of the shit hit the fan, it was like, okay, I just have to let my body do what it, I want to start focusing on feeling good. I will let it do whatever it needs to do. I'm not going to look at the scale. That's probably going to entail some weight gain because of the restrictive mindset I used to have about food. But when I started focusing on performance and how I felt and stopped worrying about the scale, that's when the actual magic happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's something that we can all take and learn from, especially because I think when we're in the short-term mindset, it's normally due to body composition goals. Sometimes it's due to trying to escape from pain or dramatic symptoms, which is understandable. But mm-hmm. in either case, if we can put our health first and start to look at those parameters as wins, you know, getting more sleep or feeling better in whatever way, like having really deep and restful sleep and being in a good mood and not being angry or irritable, or having a strong libido or feeling more energy to go be active, seeing, you know, improvements in, like, I don't know, some skin issues or your nails growing faster, all sorts of things can all mm-hmm. be really great signs. Or again, a big one, you know, on the gut side, like not feeling bloated, having normal bowel movements. I mean, if we can start to put those things first, and I think that is of utmost importance. That's always the thing I'm doing, is those are the markers that we want to be signs that we're heading in the right direction, and the weight will come. The body composition will come. And as you said, sometimes if we're coming from a lot of restriction, there might be some weight gain to start because we've been operating on borrowed time. And that's, we have to pay that back sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's part of the journey. But if we continue on that journey and we're seeing all of our health markers go in the right direction, the weight will plateau and then it will come down, as long as we're doing things that are supportive of our health. Mm-hmm. Again, if we're at a very unhealthy or underweight situation, then we might not get back down to that point, but that probably is a good thing. You know, mm-hmm. these things are all individual, but
yeah, absolutely. Well, if my listeners want to go and find you, how do they go and do that?
So you mentioned good places to start. And so I have a free mini course for any listeners that they can find at jfeldmanwellness.com/energy. And in that mini course, I go over some basic recommendations as far as changes dietarily, looking at the different macronutrients, digging into the different types of foods, you know, how we can restore digestive capacity, also what we should be doing to manage stress and as far as movement and exercise goes. So that, I think, is a really great starting place. And again, they can find that at jfeldmanwellness.com/energy. And if they're interested in any other or more information, I have a podcast called the Energy Balance Podcast. And that can be found on any podcast platform. And then also my website, which is jfeldmanwellness.com. We've got a bunch of articles there, and then also links to the podcast, some other info. And then on social media, so Instagram, my handle is @jfwellness.
Awesome. I love that. And I will make sure and place all that in the show notes as well, so people can come find you and look more into what you do and get any answers to the questions that might have arisen during our podcast episode.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks so much for having me, Connie.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. To learn more about me, my online programs, or to inquire about coaching, please visit www.connienightingale.com. And remember, nothing in the contents of this show is intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any illness, and it is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult with your primary care physician before implementing any new health protocols.